Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on advertising when we come back. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, but then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, berries from Guatemala. Our food supply here in the United States is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. This globalization may be good for business, but globalization is not good for you, and it's not good for me. Back in 1940, we Americans had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more. Today, we have a 3-day supply in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all. But over the past 60 years, we've traded that 1-year food supply for 3 days. Now, these global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years or so. Well, so says the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause, and then let you and I live for ours. Now, let me show you from the Scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. To learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours or order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about advertising. Advertising is a controlled lie, and it's very scientifically put together. And last time I pointed out to you that we first began to discover this back in 1918, scientifically. How often do people lie to you? The answer is 25%. Everybody. You, me, the judge, the prosecutor, the salesman, the sales clerk, the teacher, the principal, the professor. All of us lie 25% of the time. Now, we don't always intend to. You know, if you said to somebody, well, now, are you a liar? Most people would say, well, no, I'm not. What they mean by that is, well, I'm not deliberately trying to deceive you. And that's the truth. Most people, when they're in conversation or when they're relaying to you a story, as we demonstrated in the last program from Professor Swift's analysis back in 1918, that when you tell somebody a story, give them a report, and that person then goes to somebody and says, well, let me tell you what I heard. And then that person tells the next person. By the time it goes through 8 people, it's totally unrecognizable. There'll be 2 or 3 true facts, and that'll be about it. So if I started off by telling you 10 facts in a paragraph that I read out of the newspaper, and then you went to, let's say, Dad, and you said, well, let me tell you what George told me, you would have probably five or six of those facts correct. And then by the time your dad told it to your mom, he would have about three facts correct. And by the time it was told to your brother John and maybe to your sister Sally, it would be totally unrecognizable. And that's why in court we're so careful to exclude hearsay testimony. We don't want to know what Sally told Jane. We want to know, what you heard, and what you saw. And even when you come into court to tell just exactly what you know, what you heard, and what you saw, 25% of it will be inaccurate, incorrect. That's a lie. And that's when you want to tell the truth. And if you're trying to shade it a little bit, if you're trying to hide something, then the percentage goes up. Now, in modern times, we have more scientific and better tools to use than Professor Swift had. Let me recount for you an example. You take your subjects, that's you and me and three or four other people, and they set us down. And they have us actually view eyewitness testimony. And you and I are going to sit here at a picnic table, and we're going to watch a picnic, and we're going to watch four people with four children, a total of eight people, with a boat water skiing and picnicking on the lakeshore. And as we're watching, we're free to take notes. We can have a pen and paper. We can write down what we're observing. And there's two video cameras at 90 degree angles, and they're photographing the exact scene. They're photographing these eight people having a picnic and water skiing. And pretty soon they take off with the boat from the dock or the pier or the shore, and somebody's out water skiing, and they come back, and maybe they're cooking hamburgers, and maybe this is the 4th of July, and two video cameras are rolling, and they're photographing this entire event. And you and I and several other people are sitting here at various benches, and we're at various locations circling these people, and we have a pen and paper, and we're taking down notes, and we're writing, and we're observing, and we watch this event for about 60 minutes, and then the moderator comes over, says, "Okay, time's up," and he says, "Now let's go over and let's take a test. Let's see what it is that you observed here. We're going to test your memory. We're going to test your powers of observation." And they sit us down and they ask us 100 questions concerning the event that we just saw. You can do this in another circumstance. You can just show somebody a video. You can take them into the movie and let them watch a movie or a video or something of that order. And then you can come back and you can test them by asking them 25, 50, 75, 100 questions, something like that. And here's what will happen. When you get to the end of your test and it's corrected and you get it back, you'll have approximately 25% of your answers will be incorrect. For instance, a question may be asked, what color was the boat? Now remember, there's 10 people watching this event. There's no tricks being used. It's just a matter of, do you remember what the color of the boat was? And was the boat black? Was it dark blue? Was it gray? What was the color? And then, unlike multiple choice questions where we put down, was the boat black, gray, dark blue, or red? And you think to yourself, oh, now I remember what color the boat is because they told you the answer. But you see, when we're testing observation in court, we don't give you multiple choice questions in court. We ask you, what did you see? What did you hear? What do you know? What color was the boat? And do you know that 25% of the people will not be able to remember what color the boat is? So they will guess. It was dark red. It was maroon. They'll have all kinds of colors down there. All right. Now, we could ask you the next question. What was the model or the brand of boat? Was it a Chris Craft? Was it a Starlight? Was it a wooden boat? Was it fiberglass? We're just going to ask you questions. Was it an inboard or an outboard? And, you know, people will answer those questions. And most often, and here's the big surprise, people will answer the questions to the best of their recollection, and they very rarely ever say, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. There's something about saying I don't know that shows me up as being ignorant or non-observant, or I'm not doing my job, or I'm mentally incapacitated to say I don't know, I don't remember. You see, the truth is, I don't remember, I don't know, I didn't make that observation, or the observation didn't register in my mind. And so we try to answer the questions, and here's why you get off. Here's why you answer incorrectly. It's because your mind isn't really capable of recording all of this information. That's what the bottom line is. Your mind has stops on it, has limits. Nobody's ever told you that before, but I'm going to be the first. It has limits and stops. So those of us that are engaged in law, those of us that do cross-examination or examination, we deal with witnesses and their recollection. We recognize that because we've all been trained out of Wellman on cross-examination. We already knew this going in. The judge, the prosecutor, the defense attorneys, they all know that when they ask you these questions, 25% of your answers are going to be incorrect. Now, you're not intentionally trying to deceive, but you are deceiving the fact finder when you give answers off the top of your head instead of saying, I don't know, I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember. So, when you get through with the test, and you get corrected, and we tell you that it wasn't an inboard, it was an outboard, and it was a Mercury 65, and the boat was green, and it wasn't black, and it wasn't dark blue, or whatever answer you put down, you will say, I know what I saw, I was an eyewitness. That's what you're going to say. That was trick photography. They have changed the film to deceive me. You won't say, well, boy, I'm really surprised. I gave 25% of my answers incorrect, and lo and behold, I'm wrong. No, you're not going to say that. You're going to say, I'm right, and that film is wrong. You're going to say, no, they tricked me. They're deceiving me. Now, there was a very important number that came out of the professor's experiment in 1918. Remember, there's 29 people here in the experiment, 29 observers, and 8 of them identified somebody who wasn't even there. Well, 8 out of 32 is 25%. And we now know that 30% of all rape convictions are bogus. So if you take a prison population and you've got 100 rapists convicted by juries in the United States of America and locked up in prison, 30 out of that 100 are innocent, statistically. Of course, we don't know which 30 out of the 100 are innocent, but we do know that statistically, 30% of them are innocent. And we know that now from DNA evidence. You see, a rape conviction requires an eyewitness identification by the victim. And so the police are really the culprits in this, because when a woman has been raped and she's been traumatized, and she's excited, and remember, this is the excitement of the moment, you'd think that somebody that's being traumatized, you know, and being raped would be able to identify her attacker. You know, was he black or white? Was he Oriental? You know, can we identify his race? How tall was he? Was he 6 foot? Was he 5 foot 5? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he medium height? What was his build? Was he stocky? Was he skinny? Was he fat? I mean, you know, these are kind of basic identification markers, aren't they? All right, so what happens is this woman is brought into the police department. Now, the police are under pressure to come up with a guy that who's the guilty party. The public and the press, you know, they press upon the police, and so the police are under pressure. And this lady, she wants to identify this guy. She's just mad as hell. And on top of that, she wants to prevent this from happening to somebody else. And all these people mean well. So they bring in some rapists. And they'll usually have some rapists, you know, that are out on parole or something. And so they pick up five or six and they put them in a lineup. And then they bring this woman in and they say, okay, well now, we don't know who raped you, but now from your description, can you pick out the guy? And this woman will look and she'll say, well, no, I can't. So based upon this woman's statement, and then based upon what the police know about these 5, 6, 8, 10 rapists that are here in the city, they will say, well, based upon our best educated guess, we think that it's Joe Bologna over there. So they take this woman, you know, behind the one-way mirror, and they say, look at Joe Bologna over there. Now, where you were raped down on Jones Road, and then this guy, we picked him up about 1 mile from there, and he's a known pedophile and rapist, and he's been in prison before, and we think he's the guy. Take a good look at him. Isn't he the guy? So this is leading and suggestive is what this is. We're not testing this woman's memory. We are leading her and we're suggesting to her. This is called the power of suggestion. The power of suggestion. And it's really powerful. I'm going to write that down. Power of suggestion. Because we're coming back to that. And this woman looks at this guy and says, well, I'm really not sure. Now the police put some pressure on her and say, lady, you filed a police report. And if this is a false police report, we're going to prosecute you and put you in prison for a year. My God, here's this woman. She's a victim. A victim of a rape. She goes to the police. She says, God, I've been raped. The police go out and they find a bunch of guys. They come in there. Now the police are starting to put pressure on her. Now, it's not a crime, ladies, if you can't identify the guy that raped you. And the police want to find the guy that raped you. It's a feather in their cap. But you know, if they fail to find the guy that raped you, then it's a blot on the police. And they don't want blots, they want feathers. And besides, all of these guys in the lineup are former rapists. And so they keep pressuring this victim until the victim comes up with somebody. Tell the victim, fingers one of those 7 or 8 guys. You said he was black. You said that he was tall. You said that he was skinny. And so they pick out the tall, skinny, black guy. Not the tall, skinny, black guy that's guilty, just a tall, skinny, black guy. And that's why 30% of rape convictions are bogus. And so now, this guy who is an ex-rapist, you know, he maybe is a current rapist, we don't know, but he's been convicted before, and typically that's what they do. What they should do is to bring in 6 or 8 tall, skinny, black guys. 3 of them police detectives, and 3 of them rapists, and 3 of them, one of which was the guy that we think it is, and so can I pick one? And when she picks the police detective, who was on duty at the time in the police department with 16 witnesses, we know that this woman cannot pick out the guy that raped her. But no, they don't do that. They've got all rapists lined up here. And we're going to convict one of them for a second, third, or fifth time. All right, so now she picks out this guy over here. Now they take that guy in and they say, okay, well now this woman picked you out, loser. And this guy oftentimes will confess to this rape when faced with, well, you know, you've been convicted twice before, you're going to prison for life. But if you plead guilty to this, we'll give you 5 years. He pleads guilty and goes to prison for 5 years for this rape, or 10 years, or whatever the penalty is in your state. And the police are happy. And the woman is happy, and this guy is happy because, you know, he's not going to prison for life or 30 years or something like that. And everybody, goes away from the table. But we have an innocent man in this case. Now, I mean, maybe he deserves to go to prison a second, third, or ninth time, but I'm just pointing out that he didn't rape that woman. And whoever it was that did rape that woman gets away with it. They get away with it 30% of the time. And that's just one tip of the iceberg over here. So when we're talking about sales and advertising and what is it that people can remember, you want to remember that we're dealing with liars. And here's a salesman, the policeman, selling a rapist to a victim so that he can get a feather instead of a blot. Now let me show you how powerful this power of suggestion is. Armed with this and knowing this, you know, it's in my brain and now it's in your brain, we know this. I happened to be in jail one time. And there was a, there was a controversy over fingerprints. And the sheriff, whose name was Bill John, was suffering from what we call the little man syndrome. He wasn't a very big guy. And I am, and so therefore he wanted to take my fingerprints. Now here in Missouri we have a rule, it's Rule 30B2, that if you object to giving your fingerprints and you ask for or demand a court order, then they have to follow that rule and get a court order. Well, you know, the police, they don't want to waste a lot of time on court orders, especially when they can just slap you around, kick you up alongside the head a couple times. And most people will will see the wisdom behind the request and to just give it to them. I didn't. So some deputies came in, and in this country, we don't practice torture. So for all of you people around the world, you know, that are concerned about Americans torturing people, we don't do that in this country. What we use is pain compliance. That's spelled P-A-I-N, pain compliance. We twist somebody's arm behind their back, and the higher we raise their arm behind their back, it causes pain. And then the higher we raise it, the more pain we can inflict. Now, this is not torture. Get that out of your mind. This is pain compliance. And at some point in time, the pain becomes so great that the victim's right hand will then open up so he can be fingerprinted. See how that works? Okay. So just in case you thought we Americans over here were barbaric and torturing people, I wanted to tell you that that doesn't happen in America because we're Americans. Now, they apply this pain compliance, and sometimes you might cry out like, no, no, don't torture me anymore. Because a lot of people, they misunderstand the police intentions, and they think that that's torture when in reality it's called pain compliance. The reason I know that is because that's what the police testified to in court. No, we did not torture Mr. Gordon, we applied pain compliance. Alright, so now, this goes on for a while, and then, you know, after you've suffered enough pain, let me assure you, that when the pain level gets to be at a certain level, you will comply. That's why they call it pain compliance. I tested it, so I'm a first-hand observer, and I can testify to that. Now, this is why they tell us, the intelligence people tell us, that the information that you get from people that you torture is typically unreliable. Because after the pain has been applied to you to get you to comply, you will tell the police or the priest or anybody that's asking you anything they want to know. Isn't that real special? I mean, if they want to know if you've been planting bombs in the subway, yes, I've been planting bombs in the subway. How many? I don't remember. And then when the pain is applied to you, six, I remember now, it was six. All right, so now you've been planting bombs in the subway, and you've planted six bombs in the subway. Now, which subway? I don't remember. Now they apply the pain. Oh, I remember. And you'll tell them whatever they want to hear. Now, when they want you to sign the confession, you'll sign it. See how simple that is? It's called pain compliance. Now, it may be torture in Iraq, but it's pain compliance here in America. And we're selling this. This is a methodology of sales. This is a part and parcel with this whole concept that I'm delivering to you called advertising. The police are selling you something. So anyway, Bill John has me down on the floor. He has his boot. He's wearing cowboy boots. He has his boot on my head. Now, I don't know how big Mr. John was, but I imagine he was probably 150 or 75 pounds. He wasn't very tall. He's a short guy, but he's a little stocky. I'd say probably 175 pounds. And when he would stand on my head, see, my head is, he's got his boot over my left ear, and my right ear is on the concrete on the bottom, and my head is in between my two ears, you know. And he is standing on my head. And naturally, I was making some noises. You know, as the pain went up, my voice level went up. Now, unbeknownst to Mr. John and the deputies who had me down twisting my arms, etc., there was my wife and two witnesses outside the door to the sheriff's office, the booking office. And this door had a glass in it, and it had a Venetian blind. Now, the Venetian blind was pulled, and my wife could hear me, and she could hear my cries of anguish. And they were real cries of anguish. And there were two court stenographers walking down the hall, and there's this noise going on, you know, behind the door. And so my wife came over, knocked on the door, because she could hear my voice on the other side, and she was very concerned about my health, safety, and welfare. But again, you know, it was probably misplaced, because where could you be safer than in the custody of the police? I mean, you know, it's like being sick in a hospital. Where, what's a better place for a sick person than in a hospital? Where could you be safer than in police custody? And she was concerned about that, and so as there was this struggle on the inside by just caprice or some deputy or something happened, and somebody hit the Venetian blind and knocked it loose up at the upper, facing the door, right-hand corner, and the Venetian blind swung down. Now my wife and the two court stenographers could look plainly through the glass window at me on the floor with Bill John, the sheriff, standing with one foot on my head. Then they could hear and see my mouth and my cries of anguish. And my wife said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." Those were her exact words. "Oh my God, look at the blood." Now, there's two court ladies there. Now, these two court stenographers had probably never seen anything like this before. Probably never heard of anything like this in America. This is something that belongs with the Gestapo in Germany or with the KGB in Moscow. This does not belong in Webster County or Hartville or Gainesville, Missouri. But, you know, that's what goes on here in our neck of the woods, just in case you didn't know. Now, later on, when this case went to trial, naturally, my wife came in to testify, and I came in to testify, and these two court stenographers came in to testify. Now, remember these words. "Oh, my God, look at the blood." Seven words. "Oh, my God, look at the blood." All right. Now, the two court stenographers got on the witness stand, and they both testified as to what they saw, what they heard, and what they knew, and they both testified that there was blood everywhere. Both of them, both of these ladies testified to the blood. My wife got on the witness stand, and she testified that there was no blood, and I got on the witness stand, and I testified that there was no blood. And do you know why? And that's because there was no blood. I wish there were. It would have really aided my case if there had been blood everywhere, but there wasn't. In the excitement of the scene, of the event, the witnesses who were seeing this traumatic, exciting event didn't believe that you could have those cries of anguish, then and the scene of violence before their eyeballs without blood. You know, they've been to the movies, and they know that when people get beat up, there's blood everywhere. And maybe they've had a bloody nose, and maybe they've had a child that got hurt, you know, when they fell off their bicycle, and there was skin knees, and there was blood everywhere. Now, the police are very, very well-trained people. Policemen do not leave bruises, marks, or blood on their victims. Not in this country. I can't speak for the Germans and the Russians or anybody else. But I'm pretty well experienced at this, boys and girls, and let me tell you, in this country, and I've experienced this in Idaho and in Missouri and in California, and the police are well-trained people. They do not leave bruises, and they do not cause their victims to bleed. But let me assure you that they can apply pain that will hurt you for 2 weeks. I remember I came out of jail one time up in Idaho. God, I hurt bad for 2 weeks. But there were no bruises and there was no blood. But I hurt bad for 2 weeks. Now that's what we call pain compliance. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention is those two stenographers, those two court ladies who were totally disinterested, they didn't know me, they had never seen me before. They saw a traumatic event and the power of suggestion. When my wife said, "Oh my God, look at the blood," those ladies will die with that vision in their minds. And they testified that they saw blood everywhere. There wasn't any blood. And I was the victim, and I can tell you plainly, that wasn't true. Now, Bill John might have been guilty of a lot of things, but it wasn't cutting me up or causing me to bleed. That was not one of them. And the reason I bring that to your attention is because your powers of observation as an eyewitness are flawed. And the least reliable testimony that you can give or hear in court is eyewitness testimony. It isn't worth the powder that it would take to blow it to hell. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, to order yours, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about advertising. Now, the reason that we wanted to bring to your attention this thing of lying is because most people believe, honest to God believe, that when they see something, they can repeat that back or report that to somebody and get it true, accurate, and correct. So I'm just pointing out to you that 25% of it is incorrect, and then depending upon whether or not you want to lie, it will become less and less accurate as you add or embellish more to it. But if you're trying to relate just exactly what happened, it'll be incorrect by 25%. Now, the two ladies that I just mentioned to you, they didn't have any malice. They were just testifying to what they honest to God believed, what they saw, what they heard, and what they knew. But some of what they thought they saw, they didn't actually see. And it was that power of suggestion, that wording that said, oh my God, look at the blood, planted in their minds after this event went on. Oh my God, look at the blood. Oh yeah, there was blood everywhere. When in reality, it really wasn't there. Now, a part of the deception that comes from advertising is what you see with your eyes. And this is where Groucho Marx really shined forth. Now, he was a comedian, and he was a pretty funny guy, but one time he came up with a line, most people believe what they see. We have an old adage over here in America that says, seeing is believing. Seeing is believing. It's an old adage, you know. That's not necessarily true. And Groucho Marx came up with this line one time, pretty funny line. He says, are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? Because, you know, when you see something, you know what you saw. Your eyes are not lying to you. Your eyes are not deceiving you. But I mentioned to you the other day, did you see the movie Titanic? Honest to God, do you believe that when you saw the Titanic sinking, that you were watching the Titanic sink? No, kids, that occurred back in 1912. What you're watching here is a reproduction of the sinking of the Titanic. You're not actually watching the Titanic sink. And so the purpose of the movie maker is to make you sense, make you believe, make you a part of the scene. You know, you are sitting over here, up in the air, in a blimp, and you're watching this scene occur, unfold before your eyes. And that's the magic of the screen. But it's a deception. Now, when you live your life in this deceptive bubble, your perception of the world and your perception of life takes on that role of the surreal. It's really not real, but you believe it's real. And that's the psychologist, you know, explaining to you why it is that people identify rapists that didn't rape them. And why people will say, oh my God, look at the blood, and then testify to all this blood when in reality there wasn't any blood there at all. That's that power of suggestion. And that's where advertising comes in, and it's the power of suggestion that indelibly embellishes your subconscious mind to believe something that you didn't actually see, but you honest to God believe that you did see it. Just like those two ladies. They honest to God believed that they saw blood. And if you were to ask them today, now that was probably 15, 20 years ago. If you ask those ladies today, was there blood? They'd testify absolutely. Absolutely. And that's because they honest to God believe that. Now people believe lies. That's why people buy Ford automobiles or Chevrolet automobiles. They believe the advertising that they've seen. They believe, for instance, my dad was a Chevy man, and so am I. I don't buy Fords. I buy Chevrolets. Why? Well, because my dad always bought Chevrolets, and my dad always told me how great Chevrolets were and how bad Fords were and how bad everything else was. And so to this day, as old as I am, I'm still a Chevy man. And that just demonstrates what old Pope somebody said back about 1100. I forgot his name. That was Pope Pius or Pope something or other. He said, you give me a kid till he's 7 years old and he'll be a Catholic for life. He wasn't whistling Dixie. Adolf Hitler made an observation. He said, if you tell a lie over and over, often enough, people will believe it. Just test it. George Bush did it in 2004. Got reelected, didn't he? Now you take a look at people's opinions of George Bush in 2006 compared to 2004, and it has shifted somewhat, hasn't it? Right. So your perceptions at a given point in time may not be the same 4 years from now, and they may change. So what's the truth? Was George Bush a wonderful man in 2004, but a jerk today? Or has he always been a jerk? Then you didn't see that he was a jerk in 2004, and you don't want to admit it today. And then all of these psychological little ins and outs, you know, have a bearing on the actual and absolute truth. Now, this is why science shines through so well. You see, because when you have a DNA sample of the semen that's taken from the victim, and you compare that with the DNA, with the tall black guy that she has fingered as the rapist. You see, the test tube, the scientific laboratory is totally neutral. The laboratory or the test beaker or the DNA doesn't get a blot and doesn't get a feather one way or the other when the fact comes out that this semen does not match the semen in the victim. Or that this DNA from this guy does not match the DNA that's in the victim. See? Now, science, then, isn't necessarily the 100% arbitrator of truth either. And that's because the scientific evidence can be manipulated by the scientist that is doing the manipulation. So sometimes what we need is two or three laboratories to take the samples, and let's get a report from three. Typically, you know, if you get a report from three laboratories and you get two of them that agree at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses, God gave us that little standard to follow, then you can probably rest, you know, more comfortably with the conclusion. Now, the reason that I bring this out is because advertisers and merchants are paid professional liars. And I'm an old-timey merchant, and I'm a paid professional liar. And it was my job as a merchant to sell merchandise. And in order for me to sell that merchandise, I have to lie to you, and I have to deceive you. I have to cause you to believe that the merchandise that I'm selling is better than the merchandise that my competitor is selling, or that for some reason my merchandise is cheaper and the quality is better, or some combination of the two. Or I have to instill in you some kind of a belief, an image. Now take the Marlboro Man. The Marlboro Man, he's a rugged Western cowboy, and he's out here on the wide open plains, and he's got a package of Marlboros prominently displayed in his shirt pocket. And he's lighting up, or he's smoking away on this Marlboro, and that creates an image in your mind. Now, the truth of the matter is, you're just a little guy, and you live in New York City, and you've got glasses on, and you don't have a big, tall Stetson hat, but you would like to be that. You imagine that in your mind, and that's why you buy Marlboros. Because in your mind, when you smoke a Marlboro, you're 6'6", weigh 230 pounds, and you're not wearing glasses anymore, you're smoking a Marlboro, because people who smoke Marlboros are all 6'6", weigh 220 pounds, and they're rugged Western cowboys. That's an image. And we create that image in your mind. And we're not doing that with no good purpose. We're doing that to sell Marlboro cigarettes. And you take the Camel, you know, Joe Camel. That's an image that we are portraying. And these images become a part of what we call trademarks. Trademarks. My God, you go out here and you copy the Coca-Cola label trademark, well, they'll be on you like flies on stink. You go out here and you copy somebody's trademark. I remember I had a guy in here whose name was Vidal Sassoon. That was his name. Vidal Sassoon. Not the Vidal Sassoon that makes the cosmetics. No, this guy, his name was really Vidal Sassoon. Now, there is a product out here in the marketplace called Vidal Sassoon, and it deals with shampoo and hair care and fingernail polish, and I don't know what all, but, you know, cosmetics for women. then it's a trade name, like Coca-Cola, Pepsi. And the guy whose real name is Vidal Sassoon was also a beautician. He was a guy who ran a beauty store. And he put out a line of products which was called Vidal Sassoon. Well, when the Vidal Sassoon people in Los Angeles, California found that this guy in Texas was stealing their brand and selling their brand, Vidal Sassoon, they brought suit against him. And so this man came to me, the real Vidal Sassoon, came to me and he said, listen, wait a minute, my name is Vidal Sassoon and I'm selling Vidal Sassoon hair care products. And I said, well, that's probably true. But you see, this other Vidal Sassoon, whose name is really probably Tony Jensen, has already taken the name Vidal Sassoon, and you cannot use that name. And this guy was just really incensed. He said, but that's my name. I said, well, that may be true. I mean, your name could be Joe McDonald's, but you know, you go open up a hamburger stand and you call it McDonald's, and I'll just guarantee you that you're not going to open a store that says McDonald's hamburgers, even if your name is Joe McDonald. It ain't going to happen in this country. All right, now keep that one in mind, that these brand names and these trade names, they're jealously guarded. These images that are copyrighted and trademarked, those are advertising tools. Those are what we use to sell products to people, and they're valuable. They've got lots of money that is attached to it. And so we use those in order to merchandise and sell products, as I've said, you know, to people that don't need them, can't use them, shouldn't have them, and it's probably bad for them, but that's what we want to sell you. And so we're going to do everything in our power to sell you these goods and services that you don't need, shouldn't have, can't use, and are bad for you. And we're going to do that. Now, from your point of view, you should be alerted to the fact, which is why I thought we would talk about advertising. You should be alerted to the fact that we use a whole host and plethora of tricks and underhanded psychological moves to move our products. That's right. We use psychological warfare against you to cause you to buy these products that are probably no good for you. For instance, in our water supply, we have a deadly toxic poison. Two of them. One of them is called chlorine. Chlorine causes arterial sclerosis, that's hardening of the arteries. We have you bathing in it, and we have you drinking it. It's a deadly toxic poison, and you accept it, you drink it, you wash in it, you love it, and you die from it. And we make profit off of it. Now, the other one over here is fluoride. Fluoride is a deadly toxic poison. It's a byproduct from aluminum manufacturing. And if we didn't put it in your water supply, we would have to pay buku bucks to dispose of this stuff properly. But by convincing you that it prevents tooth decay, we can put it in your water supply, and it solves the aluminum industry's hazardous waste disposal problem. And at the same time, makes profit, makes money. It's a byproduct that we can now sell. So instead of having to pay $3,000 a ton to dispose of this toxic waste, we can charge $6,000 a ton and sell it to you and put it in your water. Does two things. Disposes of this deadly toxic waste and doubles our profit. My God, the profit on fluoride just goes off the chart. Because, you know, if you take something that costs a dollar and you sell it for $100, it's got 100 keystones in it. It's got 100 marks. If you take something that costs you a dollar to dispose of it and you can sell that for $2, how do you compute the percentage of profit on something like that? Now, our job then has to be that we have to convince you of something that is totally illogical. Now, how can you go to somebody and tell them that this deadly toxic waste that comes from the aluminum industry is good for you? It's good for your health. Well, what you do is you go out here and you get 10 dentists. And then you pay these dentists. You know, you're an aluminum manufacturer. See? You're the Reynolds Aluminum Company. And you go out and you hire 10 dentists. And you pay these 10 dentists $1 million each to do studies and research on fluoride. And so they do. And they feed this fluoride to rats and mice and all kinds of animals. And they figure out the toxic level. And that kills the rats. And so that's too much. And so we keep going down, down, down until we get a level, depending upon the weight of the rat compared to the weight of a man and how many milliliters of this stuff can we put into the water or milk or whatever we're going to put in it. Toothpaste, you know, they put that fluoride in toothpaste now. And then we figure out, you know, so that we don't kill you directly. I mean, we're going to kill you with this poison, but we don't want to do it in a week or 10 days because it becomes too obvious. But if we can kill you over 30 years, you could never blame us. So they work on that. Now, listen, you know, for $1 million, I mean, you know, what kind of a report are you going to give to the Reynolds Aluminum Company? And this is the way the John Deere people sell John Deere machinery. They go to the University of California at Davis and they say, we got a product over here called a field chopper and a wagon and we want you to test it. And so the college professor, he tests it and the John Deere company said, well, we're going to pay you $5 million to test this and give us a report. And so when it comes out, they do all the arithmetic and the math on it and they say, my God, this field chopper is the greatest thing since cows grazing on grass. And then it's just going to make you all this profit and gain. And so they go out to the farmers and they say, look, we tested these field choppers over here in California. The university came out and look at the studies. Look at all the profit you're going to make. And some of the numbers are true and some of the numbers are false and some of it's phonied up. And if there's something that's detrimental, we leave it out of the report. If there's something positive, we put it in the report. And when it's all said and done, the John Deere company sells billions of dollars worth of farm machinery to farmers, who then, after they've bought it, figure out that this stuff doesn't make a profit at all. In fact, it loses money. It costs us money, and we were better off letting the cows chew the grass off than we were field chopping and bringing the stuff into a feedlot. Now, that happens after a long time. I remember when I was a kid, back in the 50s, they came out with these field choppers, and they said, this is the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And then you got to pay extra money to haul all this manure 3 miles back down here to the field. When you have the cows grazing, see, they're already in the field pooping on the ground. Otherwise, if they poop up in the feedlot, you got to load it up in a manure spreader and take it down, spread it, and that costs you extra money. And so I just wanted to point out, that's the way we sell farm machinery. That's the way we sell fluoride. That's the way we sell chlorine. And, of course, somebody's going to say, well, my God, if we didn't have chlorine in our water, why, we would have cholera. No, it's true. I don't deny that. That's true. You know, if you're going to live in a big city like Chicago, New York, or Los Angeles, you got to have something in your water. You got to have something to kill the bacteria in the water. You know, think about it. I mean, you got people up here in Davenport, Iowa, you know, and they drink water and then they have to urinate. And they go big in the toilet and they flush that down the Mississippi River for you people down in St. Louis to drink. You people down here in St. Louis have got to do something with that water. And so you put chlorine in it, it kills the bacteria. And you run it through a filter, you know, so you can get the heavy particles out of it. I mean, you know, it's a little inconvenient to be drinking somebody else's feces, you know, so we filter that out, you know. So we can call this treated water. Now, what they don't tell you is that this chlorine over here hardens your arteries. And at about age 50, 55, 60, along in there, you know, you have a stroke, which is good for the medical industry, you know, because after all, doctors and nurses and hospitals and nursing homes, they have to have business, too. And they need people with strokes so that they can justify their existence and pay their rent and pay their car payments, you know, like everybody else. It's not so good for the stroke victims, you know, but it's real good for the nurses, doctors, and the homes that take care of them. So, you know, one hand washes the other. Now, I'm not opposed to the medical profession. I don't want you to think, you know, that I'm anti-medical or something like that. But it just seems like to me that there could be a better way. Now, there is a way that you could purify this water with ozone like they do in Paris and Moscow you know, a few other cities around the world, which is totally a non-poisonous, kills all of the bacteria, does the same job, probably costs a little more. And the same thing with fluoride over here. Fluoride does not prevent tooth decay. I know you've been told that it prevents tooth decay, and they advertise it on Pepsodent toothpaste, but that's a lie. That's not true. Got that? And those tests were bogus when they were made back in the 30s and 40s, and it was done for the express purpose of disposing of this wartime material called fluoride being developed by the aluminum manufacturers who needed a place to dump this toxic waste, and so they found it in your water supply and then turned it into a profit. And you, honest to God, to this day believe that that fluoride prevents tooth decay. Now, to give you an illustration here, just take a look in your mouth and then ask yourself how many cavities and how many fillings and root canals do I have in my mouth? And then ask yourself how much fluoride have I been drinking in my lifetime? Now, what the medicos and the salesmen say, well, my God, you know, you've got 15 cavities and root canals and all this bridge work that's done in your mouth. Can you imagine how bad it would have been if you hadn't been drinking all that fluoride? Well, you'd have two or three times that much. You have twice as many cavities. Now, I got a bunch of cows out here, and there's no fluoride in their water. None. Zero. No chlorine in their water. And there's no tooth decay in their mouths. And they do not brush their teeth. I haven't got a single cow on this farm that ever brushed her teeth. None. Zero. And there isn't a cow on this farm that's got a cavity. Of course, there isn't a cow on this farm that has ever had a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi-Cola either. Isn't that amazing? They don't have any CNH white pure cane sugar in their diets. They don't have any white flour, white sugar. All right, we'll talk a little more about that as we go along, but I wanted to take a program here, clear the air, and show you that not everything that you believe is necessarily true. And so the old adage that says, are you going to believe me or your lion eyes? It's a choice you got to make. You want to believe your lion eyes, get after it. But it's eyewitness testimony, which is the least reliable testimony that you can give in court. Least reliable. And it's the most prone to being distorted. But keep in mind that nobody lies 100% of the time. Yeah, even Adolf Hitler told the truth once in a while. Even if it was an accident, you're going to tell the truth once in a while. But deception doesn't come from lying. Deception comes from telling the truth and mixing it with a lie. That's where the deception comes from. Because if I always lied to you, you'd always know the truth. And if I always told you the truth, you'd always know the truth. But deception comes from that mixture of lying and telling the truth. The two together make the deception. And that's the way we sell fluoride and chlorine in your water. It doesn't make any sense. It's totally incongruous. But we do it every day, and you know it. And you buy it. And it's killing you. But your death is all in the overall good of the economy. So always remember that when you die, you're doing it for the economy. Hey, I got to give you a final reminder, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night talking about this thing of advertising, and I'll share a little bit more of the secrets of advertising with you. Keep in mind that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The law hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night talking about advertising. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.